Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A nearly three-month investigation into a Sacramento City Council member is complete, and accusations that Councilmember Sean Lalowe does not live in the North Sacramento district he serves, instead in a million-dollar Granite Bay home in neighboring Placer County, has been put to rest in Lalowe's favor. The independent investigation found the Sac City Council member meets residency requirements. So, where do we go from here? Kristen Lamb is CAP Radio's Sacramento government reporter and joins us with that piece of the story. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Vicky.
Okay, so this dates as far back to Councilmember Lalowe's swearing-in ceremony, but this really escalated a few months ago, sparked by an investigation by the Sacramento Bee back in June. So give us a playback of how we got here.
Like you said, some people started questioning if Lalowe lives in District 2 after he took the oath of office in December 2020. On Zoom, there were high ceilings and a fireplace behind him. People said that that didn't seem like a house in District 2, a largely low-income area. And in June, the Sacramento Bee published an article in which neighbors claimed that Lalowe lived at his wife's house in Granite Bay. And online pictures of that house matched the background of where Lalowe swore in. Later that month, Mayor Daryl Steinberg and District 2 residents called for an independent investigation into Lalowe's residency, and he agreed to cooperate a few days later.
You know, CAP Radio has reached out to Councilmember Lalowe since the beginning, and one of our colleagues, Chris Hooks, actually talked to him and interviewed him on one occasion. But what has the council member's response been from the beginning?
Yes, he's maintained that he lives in District 2, specifically in the Hagenwood home that he bought in 2019. And he's also said that he does not live at his wife's Granite Bay house, which she owns separately.
For those who don't live in the city or not even in the district, District 2, remind us about Councilmember Lalowe's background as well as the community that he represents.
So Lalowe is an Iranian immigrant and owns a few Viva supermarket grocery stores. Two of them are in the district he represents. Voters elected him to the city council in November 2020 and to represent District 2, which lies in northeast Sacramento and includes neighborhoods like Old North Sacramento, Hagenwood, Woodlake, and Del Paso Heights. And some residents say the city has underfunded the area for years.
Yeah, and we have done, you know, a series of community reporting at CAP Radio, focusing specifically on North Sacramento. This investigation really stemmed from Mayor Daryl Steinberg. He asked Lalowe to agree to an independent investigation. Why did that take place?
Yeah, so Steinberg asked Lalowe to agree to an investigation to settle questions on whether Lalowe meets legal requirements. And if he didn't agree, Steinberg said that he'd ask the council to vote on starting an investigation. And a group called the District 2 Coalition of Neighborhood Leaders also requested an investigation the same day as Steinberg. And that group includes community, business, and neighborhood association leaders.
At the core of this are residents in District 2 that want an elected official that lives in the district that they serve. So what have residents said during the entirety of this investigation?
Yeah, so since the city announced an independent investigation began in July, residents have been asking for updates. They've said that they just wanted transparency and weren't necessarily, were just looking for the truth, not looking to get him recalled or looking for some particular outcome. But until last week, when the city released the results, the city gave very little information about the investigation or its timeline.
Right. And that changed last week. So with that context and that setup, what were the results of this independent investigation?
So the investigation found that Lalowe lives in the district he represents and meets legal residency requirements. The city released a redacted version of a report by a local attorney, and Melissa Guzman. She determined that Lalowe's Hagenwood home has been his primary residence since March 2019.
And that's in North Sacramento.
Yes. And she said that Lalowe's wife and children have temporarily stayed there, but they live separately in Granite Bay and that Lalowe visits them on the weekend. And Guzman made this determination after interviews and reviewing records, including Lalowe's property tax records, driver's license, car registration, passport app, bank records, and utility bills. She did the investigation between July 18th and September 30th.
Who was the person who conducted this independent investigation?
Yeah, she's a local attorney with her own law firm. She's not affiliated with the city or Lalowe. And the Sacramento city attorney said she didn't release Guzman's name before this to prevent anyone from trying to interfere with the investigation. And a couple of District 2 residents told me that they have full confidence in her work. Here's Daniel Savala, who signed the letter requesting an investigation and is the director of the Del Paso Boulevard Partnership.
I saw the name Melinda Guzman, and I knew that it's a highly qualified and respected attorney who led it. And so we've got no questions for me after that. But again, that's just me. No reason to believe that someone who wasn't qualified didn't conduct this investigation.
Okay, so that's one person. What else did residents in District 2 have to say?
I also spoke with Mina Perez, who runs the nonprofit Vida de Oro Foundation. Now that the investigation is finished, Perez says it's important to move forward.
I believe every single individual in this community should take the approach of talk with him, you know, one-to-one. If you have to air things out, say what you have to say, hear what you need to hear. And then as adults, we need to move forward and go, okay, how am I going to work with this, or can I work with this? And you either have to come to terms with that or not. That's my stance on it. I think each individual needs to make that decision. I can only handle what I am able to do at my corner. And I definitely want to make sure that we move forward to assist the community in the right direction. We cannot keep throwing our personal feelings when it comes to something like this.
Okay, so that brings me to Councilmember Lalowe. Has he spoken publicly since the release of these findings?
So in an email to his constituents, he gave a statement saying he will continue to serve District 2. Here's part of his statement. This review brings to a close a considerably difficult period for me, my family, and my friends. We have many challenges to resolve and many opportunities here in District 2. With these distractions behind us, we can now move forward with restoring our local economy, investing in our commercial corridors, and combating our homelessness crisis. And he didn't respond to my request for an interview.
What are his colleagues on the city council saying, even the mayor?
Council members haven't really commented on the investigation. When I was talking with Vice Mayor Ashby the other day for another story, she passed on commenting on the results. Our coworker, Cap Radio reporter Chris Nichols, got a few preliminary comments from Mayor Steinberg, though, and he told him that he is confident in the independence and thoroughness of the investigation.
Okay, so where do we go from here? Is there like a pin in it? Has this investigation essentially come to an end, or is there more?
Yeah, the city attorney says that's all for this independent investigation, but a state political watchdog agency is still investigating Lalowe. The California Fair Political Practices Commission is looking into whether Lalowe failed to disclose rental income from his Hagenwood home. But the other investigative report that just finished says Lalowe allowed the family of one of his employees to live at the house with him for free. But if the FPPC finds Lalowe violated a law, he could face up to a $5,000 fine per violation.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb about an investigation which found Sacramento City Council member Sean Lalowe lives in the district he represents, following reporting and accusations that he lived outside the county at a second residence. Okay, Kristen, more broadly, are all city elected officials required to live in the district they serve? I mean, how does this work?
Yeah, so state and city of Sacramento laws require city council members to live in the district they represent. That way they hopefully understand what it's like to live there and the area's needs. Sacramento, like other cities, does by-district elections for city council members. That's different from places with at-large city council members who represent residents throughout a city. A California government code defines what a primary residence is for local elected officials, like school board members and county supervisors, too.
So what are the consequences if it's found an elected official does not live in the area that they serve and they're required to by law?
Yeah, a few things could and have happened to other elected officials, like in Stanislaus County and the city of Patterson back in 2016. The city council declared a seat vacant. Officials essentially removed council member Cherie Lustgarten from the council. That same year, a Southern California judge sentenced a former Escondido school district trustee to 3 years of probation. He was also charged with 13 felony counts. Resigning from the school board was also part of Jose Fragoso's plea deal.
Going back to Councilmember Loloi, does this independent investigation essentially clearing him answer a lot of the questions that were brought up? Is there confidence behind that? Or are there pieces left out that you wanted an answer to?
Yeah, one of the District 2 residents I spoke with pointed out a couple outstanding concerns. His name is Zach Trowbridge, and he's the vice president of the Hagenwood Community Association. At one point, the Bee reported that Loloi said his family moved to Robla for roughly 5 months. The investigative report, Trowbridge noted, doesn't mention anything about a Robla house. And he added he's also still concerned about the Bee reporting Loloi's neighbors saying they haven't seen him.
It's like, oh man, like I would really hope that my council member would know their neighbors super well, right? Like not just at all of District 2, but like right around their house. Like I wish that the answers to that would have been like, oh yeah, like Sean lives next door. Like we see him all the time, or like we had a beer last weekend, or like any level of community, right? It's just a little concerning to me that it's like, no idea who he is. Like, oh God, that's not good. Like, we got some work to do there.
And this obviously goes beyond a lone city council member. What did you learn through this entire process?
So before coming to Cap Radio at the Modesto Bee, I reported on questions about a Turlock City Council member's residency. So while this process with Sean Loloi started before I began working here, I've knocked on doors before asking if neighbors recognized an official. And here I learned that mayors can request an independent investigation to determine whether a council member lives in their district. In the past, the city attorney essentially told me investigating is the California Attorney General office's job. And to be clear, there is a process for the attorney general to determine if there's enough evidence to remove elected officials from office. Anyone can send what's called a quo warranto application to the Attorney General's office.
A quo warranto. All right. Learned something new today. Finally, Kristen, what do you want listeners to take away about elected positions, residency, and just really the checks and balances that are in place, especially given we have a midterm coming up in just a couple weeks?
Overall, people have a lot of different options to try to hold elected officials accountable. For residency questions, people can petition decision makers like a mayor or contact the state attorney general's office. And with elections coming up, I'd just add that candidates are asking voters to pick them for a job. But elections aren't the be-all and end-all of people's say in local government.
Kristen, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen Lamb is Cap Radio's Sacramento government reporter discussing an investigation which found Sacramento City Council member Sean Loloi lives in the district he represents, following months of reporting and accusations that he lived outside the county at a second residence. Up next, gas prices. We certainly feel it, and it is painful. But we're going to spend some time understanding what is going on with the soaring prices Californians have been facing this year. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Some 23 million Californians began seeing direct deposits to buffer the high cost of living in the state. The payments, which were part of a state budget deal back in June, were meant to ease the pain at the pump. Although prices aren't as high as this summer and are beginning to decline, they are still well above the national average. As of this morning, the average price of gas in California, just over $6 a gallon. The national average is $3.87. That is more than $2 less. But California's price per gallon is up 56 cents from a month ago and more than $1.54 compared to the same time last year. And that is all according to AAA. The frustration is palpable, and blame and solutions are being thrown around the partisan roundtable, especially with a general election fast approaching. But we're going to go beyond politics and make sense of the dollars we're spending at the pump. Eric Mueliger is a professor of economics at UC Davis and joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so gas and oil prices, they're complicated, but what are some of the major drivers of gas prices specifically in California?
Well, I think it's important to sort of first talk about sort of what the overall drivers of gasoline prices are nationwide, and then we can dig into sort of the California specific elements. The most important driver when we think about gasoline prices, especially nationwide, are oil prices. Oil is the most important input into gasoline, and it's the primary cost that refiners pay when they're thinking about producing gasoline. When oil prices go up, gasoline prices go up, and when oil prices go down, gasoline prices go down. We've seen this play out very clearly over the past year and a half. Going back to the start of 2021, oil prices were about $50 a barrel, and gasoline prices nationwide were $2.30 a gallon. Fast forward to the start of this summer, we saw oil prices peak at about $125 a barrel and gasoline prices nationwide over $5 a gallon. And since then, we've seen nationwide both oil prices falling and gasoline prices falling.
Right.
Now,
I believe it's $85, right, for crude oil?
It's sort of $90. Yeah, $90 is the crude oil price right now, and the average price of gasoline is about $3.80 nationwide.
I mean, so we're connecting oil and gas, you know, and a lot of people think they're one and the same, and they are very much related and impact each other, as we just learned from you. But what other factors go into the price of gas nationally and also how it trickles down and to California?
Yeah, so the story in California, you know, in many ways has followed a similar pattern to the story nationwide. So, you know, we saw gasoline prices rise through 2021 and peak at the start of the summer. And we saw gasoline prices start to fall as oil prices fell in California through sort of the beginning of September. But since then, gasoline prices have continued to fall nationwide, we've seen gasoline prices rise pretty dramatically in California to levels that were sort of comparable to what we saw at the beginning of the summer. And the sort of factors that really influence that are sort of twofold. So under normal circumstances, gasoline prices do tend to be higher in California than they are in the rest of the country. Part of that is reflective of the fact that California has higher gasoline taxes than in other parts of the country. But what's been very important over the past several weeks is also that the type of gasoline that's sold in California is different than gasoline that's sold everywhere else in the country. This is due to special environmental regulations that California has in place. These regulations have been in place for decades, I mean, since the mid-90s, and they reduce the amount of emissions that are created when people fill up their tanks, when people drive their cars. These rules have been very important and sort of a central element to California's efforts to really reduce urban air pollution. And it's been sort of a very successful element of that process. The drawback of these kinds of policies is that it makes the gasoline sold in California different than the gasoline sold everywhere else. So California tends to be much more reliant on the refineries that are in the state relative to many other places around the country or around the world. It's so much so that we often refer to California as a gasoline island because almost all of the gasoline consumed in the state is also produced in the state. And the challenge that this creates is that at periods of time where There are supply challenges in California. Those supply challenges are translated very heavily into prices at the pump and can cause the price at the pump to change in California relative to the prices in the rest of the country. This is what we've seen over the past sort of 6 weeks. At the start of September, a couple of refineries in California had maintenance that they scheduled that reduced their the amount of gasoline that they were producing. And there were a couple of refineries that had unplanned events that also reduced the amount of gasoline they were producing. And these factors led supply to decline relative to robust demand, has really driven up prices in California relative to the rest of the country.
Given that crude oil is an international market, and I understand there are things happening within the state that's driving up prices, that is even exceptionally high for California, which already has higher prices compared to the rest of the country. Is there any other place comparable to California in the world that is being impacted like our state? Or are we an island also globally?
So, I mean, we are to some degree sort of an island globally, in the sense that, you know, there are very few refineries around the world that produce gasoline on that would meet California's specific environmental requirements. And so in these periods of time where we have either planned or unplanned refinery events that reduce the amount of production capacity in the state, you know, we often see prices rise quite substantially in California relative to the rest of the country, relative to the rest of the world.
There's a lot of blame and solutions and reasons being thrown around. I'm just going to go through a few of them and get your thoughts on them. When we talk to Republican lawmakers, I mean, for them, the picture really boils down to the gas taxes in California, highest in the nation. Also, environmental regulations, which you laid out, like switching from a summer blend to a winter blend. Is that the complete picture, or are there other pieces that are being neglected from the conversation?
So I think it all comes back in many ways to the story about the type of gasoline in California being different than gasoline in the rest of the country. You know, one of the things that we see, if you look at gasoline in other parts of the country and other parts of the world, where gasoline is a little bit more fungible, a little bit more compatible, periods of time where gasoline prices rise in those locations, there are lots of sources of supply that can be brought in to make up supply shortfalls. And so if gasoline prices rise on the East Coast, you know, gasoline can be brought in from refineries in the Gulf Coast, or they can be brought in from refineries around the world. California, that's not the case. And because we have this special blend of gasoline, it's much harder to do that. And so when prices rise, you know, we do see sometimes that there are that refineries around the world will begin to produce gasoline for California and then ship it to California, but it's a much slower process.
On the flip side, the governor and Democratic leaders, we recently had Senator Alex Padilla on Insight last week. They blame these soaring gas prices on, quote, the greedy oil industry that has raked in unprecedented profits during this time, despite crude oil prices falling below $100 a barrel. I mean, Governor Newsom flat out calls it extortion. Is price gouging a fair criticism and contributor to what we're experiencing and what we're paying at the pump?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's hard to sort of think about what we actually mean by sort of price gouging. I think there's, you know, a bit of a subjective assessment there as to whether prices are reasonable, whether relative to what a fair price would be. The California Energy Commission does track the retail price of gasoline and the price of crude oil. And if you think about sort of the difference between those, the difference between those is some combination of gasoline taxes, the cost to refining and transporting the gasoline to the retail station, and refinery profits. And one of the things that we do see in California is that even when you take out the gasoline taxes, that gap is higher in California than it is in other parts of the country. You know, Severin Borenstein at UC Davis has paid attention to this for a long time and noted that this gap has increased over time, suggesting that this is not entirely driven by the cost of producing these special blends. What this comes back to, though, is it really comes back to the role that these special regulations play, you know, in California. If you think about sort of what gasoline markets might look like in other parts of the country, if that gasoline price starts to rise, there are going to be other sources of supply that come in. to try to compete away those high prices. And in California, we just don't have those alternative sources of supply that can come into the state easily.
Mm. So now Governor Newsom wants to call a special session of the legislature in December to propose a windfall tax in response to what he's accusing the oil industry of doing. What would this accomplish if it actually succeeds?
So, I mean, we've seen windfall taxes, particularly over the past year, suggested in many many different locations. Typically, if we think about sort of what a windfall tax would do, it would be a tax on refinery profits. Again, sort of coming back to the big picture here, when we think about sort of where these high prices are coming from, these high prices are coming from basically the interaction of supply and demand. We have robust demand for gasoline in this state. And over the past 4 to 6 weeks, we've had a supply shortfall relative to that demand. And that's really been what's driving up these prices in the state.
So what you're talking about is at least 5 refineries in the state recently had a shutdown for maintenance issues, which really limited the supply that we're talking about. So in your view, is that really the most significant driver on top of the taxes and the regulations that we have and the special blends that we have in the state?
Yeah, certainly that's the most important driver for the price increase that we've seen right now, over the past sort of 4 to 6 weeks, where, relative to the rest of the country, California's retail prices of gasoline followed the retail prices for the rest of the rest of the country down from June through early September. But since then, while the rest of the country's prices have continued to fall, the price in California has risen to the point, as you noted at the start of the segment, where gasoline prices are, over $2 a gallon more expensive than gasoline prices in the rest of the country.
What was interesting for me to learn was that California has a very small share of off-brand stations. These are like mom and pop owned gas stations compared to other parts of the country. What is the benefit to these off-brand stations? And do you believe this is also a contributing factor?
So, I mean, I think it's good to recognize that, the stations themselves are setting prices, and so they have some control over this. But when we think about sort of the overall drivers for the prices we've seen, certainly over the past sort of 4 to 6 weeks, this is really being driven by that supply shortfall that we've experienced at the refinery level. So even if you have a location that maybe has, a few more mom and pop unbranded stations that might be, might price a little bit more aggressively or things like that, this is really sort of a story about, rising cost of gasoline to these stations, sort of pushing up the prices statewide.
Okay, so this is essentially supply issues compounded with historically already high prices of gas in California relative to the rest of the country. So then, given that, we're not immune to what also happens around the country and the world, I mean, is the Russian invasion of Ukraine continuing to put a strain on California? I even think of Hurricane Ian. I mean, did that actually impact the supply here in California? Or were we have these unique challenges because we're kind of this gas island?
So, I think there's sort of two answers to that. The first is that anything that affects the overall price of oil is going to have an effect on California. When we see oil prices go up worldwide, gasoline prices go up worldwide. And we saw this actually, sort of the end of February and March of this year, sort of at the start of the invasion of Ukraine, we saw oil prices and gasoline prices rise, worldwide. In response to that. But there are these sort of California specific factors that particularly arise when California experiences these supply shocks. Now, it's important to note that there are sort of reasons to be optimistic. There are sort of sources of, positive reasons why we might expect gasoline prices to start to fall in California over the next several weeks. So, in particular, those refinery outages that I talked about, those reductions in production capacity for California refineries, those are being resolved. Those refineries are coming back online. They're increasing production, and so that shortfall is going to diminish. In addition, there was a policy change that happened. So the special type of gasoline we use in California is particularly stringent in summer months when air pollution is the worst. And Governor Newsom and the state of California recently moved the date at which those regulations become less stringent. Normally that happens at the start of November, and they moved it to the start of October. Both of these have already started to have a big effect on the market for gasoline in California, although we haven't really seen it at the pump quite yet. So if you look at the spot price of gasoline in Los Angeles Harbor, so this would be the price that a company would pay if they wanted to buy gasoline at the harbor. What you see is basically that price has fallen by about $1.50 a gallon, or about a third, over the past week or week and a half. Now it's going to still take a little while for that price reduction to make it to wholesale terminals, which is where retail stations buy their gasoline from. And it's going to take a little while longer for that to be reflected in the price at the pump. But we've already started to see some indications that prices are declining in California. Over the past week, retail prices have fallen by about 30 cents a gallon. And as that sort of price reduction continues to work its way through the system, we would expect over the next few weeks, in the next certainly few months, that prices would continue to fall.
Okay, so that's promising and a downward trend, which is good. Could that downward trend be impacted, though? In response to earlier this month, I believe OPEC, specifically Saudi Arabia, making a decision to cut oil production since it is an international market as well. Could that impact or challenge this downward trend that we're hopefully continuing to see in California?
Sure. So it's always tougher to project sort of longer term. Sort of world oil prices are influenced by lots of factors which are hard to predict, as we saw earlier this year with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That said, I think there are sort of a couple of trends that some of which sort of lead us to believe that gasoline prices might continue to fall, some of which are going to be pushing in the opposite direction. So the biggest, I think, factor out there right now is as the Federal Reserve and as central banks around the world continue to raise interest rates, that tends to have a cooling effect on the economy, reducing demand for gasoline, and tends to put downward pressure on gasoline prices. Now, this was actually the motivation for OPEC to announce that they were planning to reduce production capacity of oil starting in November. So OPEC recently announced they were going to cut production by 2 million barrels per day, which is about 2% of global production. The reason OPEC announced this was to provide some upward support for oil prices so that they might not fall as much as they otherwise would as economies around the world start to cool off because of higher interest rates. I think the other sort of important thing to note, to sort of keep an eye out for longer term, is relates to China. In particular, we've seen over the past year China take a very conservative approach to reopening their economy, and this has tended to reduce the demand for transportation fuels in China. If China decides to reopen more fully, as they reopen more fully, we would expect that demand for things like gasoline and other transportation fuels to increase. And that would be sort of another source that's going to potentially provide some upward pressure to push against the forces of sort of the cooling economy that we're seeing as a result of higher interest rates.
So a lot of factors at play. I go back to the refineries in California that had to shut down for maintenance issues, and that was a significant driver to the prices that we're seeing now. As you said, those refineries are starting to come back online, but do you think these shutdowns are potentially a sign of larger vulnerabilities in the state's energy infrastructure? I mean, was this unusual that we had five refineries have to shut down, and could this happen again?
I mean, I think both planned and unplanned maintenance events are not uncommon. So refineries have to regularly go down for planned maintenance. And most of the time they plan that maintenance, in the spring and the fall, where demand is, you know, a little bit less, a little bit lower than it is in the summer months. In fact, the planned maintenance events that most recently occurred had been postponed from the start of the summer when gasoline prices were particularly high in the state. Unplanned events also occur, and we see these occur periodically. And the challenge in California is that because we have this very special blend of gasoline, we don't have other sources of supply that can easily come in to meet a supply shortfall that comes about because of unexpected reasons. And so, when you have these capacity reductions at refineries that arise because of an unplanned event, we do see gasoline prices tend to rise, substantially in response to that. That's what we've seen over the past sort of 4 to 6 weeks. But we see it periodically. We saw it, in 2015, there was a fire at a Torrance refinery that led gasoline prices in the state to rise. We've seen it periodically. And this is, something which, is a challenge that, the state's, gasoline market has to face because of the fact that, the gasoline in the state is special relative to the gasoline that's sold everywhere else.
Industry analysts, or some of them, are predicting that $5 a gallon may be the new normal for a while. Where do you stand on that? Do you think that that's going to be the case?
That's a good question. I mean, I think if I had a crystal ball, I'd love to.
Right over $6 now. So,
yeah, I'd love to provide you with a clear answer to that. I mean, I do think we are going to see a period of time in California where prices are likely to decline a substantial amount. Again, under normal circumstances, gasoline prices in California are between 50 cents, sort of 75 cents per gallon higher than gasoline prices in the rest of the country. Right now, we're sort of $2.20 above the prices in the rest of the country. So there is, a ways, I think, that gasoline prices can fall in California. You know, that said, longer term, what really matters is sort of this interplay of supply and demand in the overall oil market. And, if factors continue that keep oil prices elevated, we might see gasoline prices fall pretty substantially in California over the next few months, but we might not be returning anytime soon to, $2.30 a gallon gas.
Yeah, that takes me back like a decade. Professor Mueliger, what it feels like more than a decade. Professor Mueliger, thank you so much for breaking all this down.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Eric Mueliger is a professor of economics at UC Davis. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. They say there are two guarantees in life, death and taxes. Well, if you're a Sacramento Kings fan, you can add another, missing the playoffs. That has been the case for the past 16 years. An entire generation of fans have never seen their hometown team in the postseason. Tomorrow night, the Kings will kick off another season of NBA basketball, full of hope to finally make it to the postseason and break the longest active streak of any team in professional sports. That's right. No team in hockey, baseball, football, or basketball, the four major pro sports, have experienced a postseason playoff drought like our beloved Sacramento Kings. The dream has always been of rallies and parades along Capitol Mall, but since 2007, those dreams have been dashed. So, will this be the year? Fox 40 sports reporter Sean Cunningham has covered the team for years and joins us to weigh in on if this could be the season where the Kings finally make it. Good morning, Sean.
Vicky, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Sean. All right, let's do a visualization exercise. Put on some rose-colored glasses and imagine just for a minute what the city of Sacramento would look like and feel like if the Kings have a successful season, make it to the playoffs.
Oh boy, this place would go crazy. I mean, you would see, like, if anyone saw the NBA Finals in the way Golden State Warriors or even the Milwaukee Bucks and the plaza that's outside of their arenas, what those look like just for viewing parties for the NBA Finals, I feel like it would look very much the same, just littered with people to watch even a play-in game. And to explain that, like, look, you've got more than half the league that makes the playoffs, but then they've even expanded it. So if you're a 7, 8, 9, or 10 seed in the West, that's called the play-in tournament. If you enter that one of those spots, it's not the playoffs, but you have a chance to compete and make a playoff roster. So if you go, if you fall seventh and then you make the advance into the tournament and then you win the tournament and they get to go into the playoffs, I think that Doco Plaza would be absolutely overflowing with fans to even see and get a taste and watch outside the building as this Kings team competed for the playoffs.
Let's go back to when the Kings actually did make the postseason. You know, this was more than 16 years ago. What was it about that run of playoffs, of playoff years, that made the team so special?
Well, you even have to go back further than that. I mean, we're about to enter the 38th season of Kings basketball in Sacramento, and only 10 seasons have they ever made the postseason.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's really awful for a franchise. We look at a league where literally half the league's teams make the playoffs. So, it's been 16 seasons, like you said, and that was the last of, I think, 8 straight at the time. You know, fans got a little spoiled, you know, in 01-02. That's the season where they've gone the farthest they'd ever gone. It was the 01-02 Western Conference Finals against the Lakers. We all know how that turned out, which you were one series from the NBA Finals. Now, you trickle that around for another 7 years, or I think it was 6 years after that. Fans got a little spoiled, and postseason success just, you know, kind of got a little bit mundane because you weren't able to punch through and get any further than that. So even that playoff series loss, the in 06 where they lost to the Spurs, it was a first round exit. Mm-hmm. It was an exciting series. I mean, Ron Artest got suspended in that series. There's so many things that happened, but they had a chance to beat the Spurs in that series, and Kevin Martin hits a thrilling game winner. Arco Arena looks amazing, and then they don't make it again. So I think fans, if they ever punch through the postseason, and hopefully this is the year for them, if that ever happens, I don't think they're going to take playoff run for granted ever again. I mean, those appearances are special, especially in small markets like Sacramento.
Well, take us back to after that final playoff season. I mean, generally speaking, what were some of the main factors that have played into the Kings' 16 years long misfortune?
For sure. I mean, you had a head coach like Rick Adelman who was able to sustain these long playoff runs and contend in the postseason. That was his final season. And then you went on from coach after coach after coach. It's been in a revolving door, as Kings fans know. And here you are, you know, 16 years later, and you're still hoping to find continuity. You know, talent has a big part to do with that. You have new ownership now. The Maloofs are gone. You have Vic Ronadive stands in. You have a great brand new building in Sacramento. The fight to keep the Kings from leaving from Anaheim or even Seattle is well documented. And now you've got this beautiful arena there, and it's still been a very long playoff drought, and they're inching their way towards it. And I think the biggest thing, I mean, there's been a lot of chaos from front office. They're trying to hold people accountable. You've got ownership that's going to meddle a little bit as well, and they're going to want to see what, you know, they can put their fingerprints all over everything, and they're involved in every decision. So I think really what, if you had to break it down to one thing, it's a little bit of two C's, I like to call chaos and continuity. The lack of continuity within the coaching ranks and front office and hoping to stick with the plan, but when it doesn't work, not being able to throw everything into chaos and try to fix it right away or try to tinker to where all of a sudden you have to have a new coach every 2 years. And that's really been a hard thing because they really want to, you know, it's not for lack of trying. And I think the not for lack of trying tends to disrupt a lot of the continuity and consistency that they're searching for. So I think right now, they realize that you can't just remove a head coach after every single year. You have to give it some time. And so they've done it, I think, the right way. It began last year. They traded a very beautiful piece of their future to try to improve them right now. They got rid of Tyrese Halliburton, who was a very young, bright, budding star, sent him to Indiana and got a two-time All-Star in the Eastern Conference in Domantas Sabonis. And you pair that with De'Aaron Fox, who's your longest-tenured king, for 6 years, getting into his sixth NBA season, it takes a little bit of pressure off him. Now you've got this two-headed monster, if you will. And I think that the bringing those two players, doubling down on the little bit of success they had once they brought in Sabonis last year, they feel that this can be the players that can get it done. And now you build around that and you add some shooting like Malik Monk and Kevin Huerter and even new head coach in Mike Brown. And Mike Brown has been that glue right now. He's probably the biggest offseason acquisition that they have. And they want to trust in that continuity, his structure, his discipline, all the things that he brings, the attention to detail, a little bit of OCD. It's his first year. We'll see how things go, but he kind of needs that time to get things done, and he's got a great staff, and there's a lot of excitement right now.
I mean, you spend a lot of time at games. You're actually going to be heading to practice after our conversation. You talk to fans. What is it about the Sacramento Kings that keeps fans coming back season after season? I mean, you see Sac King jerseys everywhere, all over the city.
The loyalty in this city is like a college atmosphere. I mean, you know, it's people just love it. It's all you have. You're the little brother of the Bay Area. You know, you see what goes on with the Warriors, and the Sacramento Kings are your only professional sports team. So where else can you go in Sacramento on a Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at night, and see a sold out building? I mean, you had sold out for the preseason for against the Lakers, as you always do. That's always the rivalry that people love to see. But it's that sense of civic pride. You know, people want to see this team do well, but they're also tired of supporting a losing franchise. And so it can start to wane a little bit. You know, it's not hard to look down the road at what the Warriors have, which is a dynasty with superstar players, and kind of have a little bit of envy with what they're dealing with. So the hope is you have loyal fans and they want to be able to see this Kings team win, and giving them a small taste of success will go a long way. And hopefully this is the year for them, because this is a tortured fan base, Vicky.
Yeah. What goes into that legacy of having a combination of and the chemistry of a superstar team like the Golden State Warriors? What is it that a team like the Warriors have that the Kings have been missing?
Well, it's bigger than superstar talent, I can tell you that. It's a buy-in from top to bottom. Ownership supports franchise. You don't have not that Sacramento has a frugal owner. I mean, they don't. I mean, they spend a lot of money on their product. They really do. But you're not really playing with the same deck of cards. When you have someone like Steph Curry, you have someone like Klay Thompson and Draymond Green. Those are three all-star superstar players. And you have a generational talent in Steph Curry who literally transcended the game. So that's a huge advantage. And when you think about what they're stepping into in their future, there's a thing called luxury tax. There's salary caps within each season. Each team has to meet a salary cap. And if you go above that, you're paying luxury tax. And going above that salary cap, for every dollar you spend, it's almost like spending $5 on top of that. Oh. So their luxury tax could approach over $400 million to keep some of those players. You have very deep pockets. You have huge sponsorships. You have a great big TV deal. There's things that go into it. The Kings have a fraction of that in a smaller market. So it's they're not playing nearly the same game, but it all starts with the talent on the floor. And if you can get that talent on the floor, that will go a long way. And you don't have a superstar player, unfortunately. You don't even have an all-star player. You're hoping that maybe you do. You've got a player with all-star caliber player like Sabonis, maybe a future one in De'Aaron Fox. But all you need is a little bit. All you need is a spark and something to go with, and then hold on to that continuity. And who knows what you might be able to come through with. And I think they feel that Keegan Murray, their rookie, can pair nicely with these guys, and maybe he is a budding superstar.
All right, well, then I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Do you think the Kings are going to make the playoffs this year with the roster they have, barring any major injuries?
Well, I'm glad we started off. If someone just, you know, hopped on this conversation and didn't hear me talk about the difference between the playoffs and the play-in tournament, there is a difference. So if they can get a 7-10 seed in the Western Conference, they can make the play-in tournament and then have an opportunity to make the playoffs if they win that series. I'm guessing they won't make the playoffs. However, I do see the Western Conference provide an opportunity for that play-in tournament. So I think they're about a 9 seed right now. I mean, who knows? Trade deadline comes in. They can tinker with this team around the February All-Star break. They might be able to add some more firepower if things are going well and make a run for that playoff spot. So if I've got a crystal ball in front of me, I'm thinking probably 39 wins, which is the most they've had in a long time. I think they're going to be hover right around a 500 basketball team. And if they can punch into that playoff, that postseason playoff tournament, and possibly get into the playoffs, I think they have a great shot to do so. Some of those teams that would hover around them, possibly the Lakers, the Trailblazers, maybe the New Orleans Pelicans. Those are some of the teams you might have to look out for and compete with. But I think they've got a really, really good shot, and it's probably the best shot they've had in those 16 years, Vicky.
Would that be a successful season for you?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, even if, you know, 500 basketball, they haven't. That would be the best season they've had in that span. Even if you're slightly below that, you know, 39 wins is not quite 500 basketball, but it's hovering right around that. That would be outstanding. They did have 39 wins under Dave Yeager a few years ago, before Luke Walton was the head coach, and then now Mike Brown. But, you know, they weren't able to punch through, and they were relevant, and they didn't have the postseason play-in tournament at that time. Now that they do, 39 wins will get you into that tournament. It should get you into that tournament. So I think some fun things are on the horizon. I think they'll have their opportunity. And, you know, who knows? I hope I'm wrong, because I think Kings fans know they deserve it. And if they can, you know, hover around that mark and make that push, like I said, and maybe add another piece along the way this season during the trade deadline, I think that can go a very, very long way. And there could be something special here.
Sean, thank you so much. I learned so much from you this morning.
Did you? Oh, I appreciate you, Vicky. Good to see you.
Sean Cunningham is a sports reporter with Fox 40 here in Sacramento. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.